show.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. This is Lisa Anderson here with you. Here's what's coming up later. For our inbox, we have a girl who's been interested in a guy at her church for a couple of years, and she's really hoping that he's going to ask her out at some point. So can she actually do anything to maybe make this happen? And then for our culture segment, Nancy Piercy has written a book called The Toxic War on Masculinity. If you're familiar with Nancy, she has written a lot of books, and she's written books like on behalf of people. So she knows her stuff. She's a researcher and is going to address why this whole idea of masculinity is up for debate in our culture and what it looks like from a biblical perspective. So check it out. Well, here we are for our roundtable, though, and we're going to go maybe a little bit lighter here. We're going to talk about spending our weekends in a way that maybe is restful, maybe fruitful, productive, fun, whatever. We're going to see if we can accomplish all of these things in one weekend. I don't know. Some of us maybe do better at this than others. And so we have got Georgia, Christina, and John here. Hey, y'all.
Hello. Hey, Lisa.
Good to have you. Okay, Christina, this is your first time being on a roundtable. So welcome.
Thank you.
We're hoping that you're a weekend expert. So
we'll
we're very excited to hear about this. So, so first up, we're taping here not on a weekend because we're all at work, but straight up, is there anything unique about your upcoming weekend? So we're just going to start with that. What's going on this weekend? Anything unique, or is this not a unique one? I'm going to be honest, for me, it's not going to be a unique one, so I'm not even going to dwell on it. I have an upcoming talk this month that I basically have to work on. So that's my weekend.
That's super fun. Yeah. I'm going on a ski trip.
Oh, my goodness. That's so amazing.
I won't be skiing because it's too expensive, but I'll be snow tubing, which is super
fun.
Too. Okay. So yeah, that's exciting.
Okay. Are you going to have like a, are you worried about a fun outfit to tube in?
Or well,
you...
of course. Okay. I thrifted some Columbia bibs. So even though I won't be skiing, I will be wearing snow gear to romp around in.
That's very legit. We will give you credit for that. John, how about you?
Yes, I wish I could invite all of the listeners to this because by the time that this airs, it will have already happened. But I'm participating in a gumbo cook-off with my roommate. I'm one of his chef assistants, and I'm very excited about it. We did this last year.
Okay,
possibly.
John, I have to interrupt you because you literally just said, a gumbo cook-off. Like, you got a lot more Southern just even saying that.
Okay. I will not hide it whatsoever. But very, very excited for that.
That's good.
And yes, one of the best smelling environments I've ever been in my life.
Okay. Well, that's amazing that there are people that are gifted at that because that's fascinating. I love it. Okay. Christina?
Yeah. So this Saturday, I will be writing a 16-page paper for for my grad school class. So hopefully that's unique because I don't want to be doing that necessarily every weekend. But yeah, so I'll be doing that most of the day Saturday.
Okay, that is unique. It is also triggering for a lot of just schooling from past and present and people who are listening, I'm sure. So I say that because I actually wrote I think at that particular paper was a 12-page paper that I lost in its entirety on basically my last page of writing it when it was due the next day.
Oh, no.
And so I had to start from scratch. And so it still haunts me.
That's so sad.
So sorry.
It was terrible. It was a crash of catastrophic proportions that was not recoverable. So I'm just going to be honest. Okay. Would you say that you guys mostly are, let's hope, you know, that we have all found joy in our work to some extent so that we don't live for the weekends. But would you say you look forward to the weekends, or can you pretty much just kind of jam throughout the week and find joy in an average Tuesday? Or what do you feel like? Where do you guys feel you land?
I really do look forward to the weekends because there's a sense of, hey, I can unplug now. Mm-hmm. That's what I really enjoy about the weekends. But I definitely need both. I think we can all testify, hey, we need a reason to get up Monday through Friday and to be productive, to go and live for a purpose greater than ourselves. But it is fun to look forward to the weekends as well. I think having both as part of a work-life balance is a real blessing because we're not supposed to be working all the time. We've got to have some fun mixed in.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I would say similar. I do enjoy my work in the work week, but I also think the weekends are a good time to just spend time building relationships and friendships and just having that time to relax a little bit and focus on some more maybe fun things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think you can enjoy your work while also being like, yes, I look forward to the weekends. Because, I mean, I love the work I do. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, work is work. Mm-hmm. And I guess to John's point, you need the weekend to kind of recoup, recover, and do things that are outside of your day-to-day, you know.
Yeah. So what does a weekend look like for you guys typically? I mean, we talked specifically about this coming weekend, but what does it feel like? Like, is your Saturday different than your Sunday? And actually, let's answer that first, and then I have a follow-up off of that. So who wants to start that?
I can start.
Okay.
Saturdays are definitely random for me. Mm-hmm. There could literally be some days where I'm going out hiking and I'm getting up at 3 a.m. to go and hike. There are other Saturdays I'm sleeping until 10 and it feels great. There are some Saturdays I get out and go to a pumpkin patch. There's other Saturdays where I can just hang out all day by myself. But Sundays are very routine. Mm-hmm. I get up and I go to church. I watch racing Sunday afternoon and I go run errands after that. And I do the same errands every Sunday. Hmm. I fill up my tank of gasoline in the car and then I go to the grocery store and get groceries for the week.
Okay. That is pretty structured. Okay. How about you two?
Lately, my Saturdays have been doing homework. Mm-hmm. So making that more fun instead of just doing it in my room on my desk. I've been going in coffee shops and just having something fun to look forward to while doing homework. And then after that, I typically run errands. So Saturday's the day I fill my gas up and go to the grocery store and the car wash if needed. Sundays typically look like waking up, going to church. And then a lot of times after church, people will come over to my house and we used to watch football, but football season's ended. So now we'll see what it is now. We'll have to pick a new sport or something and just kind of relax on Sundays. Sometimes cooking, meal prepping.
Okay. Well, that's got to make you look forward to Sunday then, to have that kind of squirreled away, that time.
Yeah.
Because you know you're not going to do homework. That's good. Georgia?
I think Saturdays are pure chaos. Who's to say? Who's to say?
On the regular? Chaotic generally?
Yeah. Every Saturday looks different. Okay. And usually I feel like there's like a morning activity and then like a noon activity and a night activity. So it's just like, who's to say? Like I usually fill up Saturday to the brim just to have fun because on Sundays I like to be super recoup, recovery. That's like my chill day. I don't really like to have plans because I like to be like prepping for the week and preparing my heart for another week. And yeah, I just like that day as a full rest day.
Mm-hmm. That's good. So the follow-up to that, because I would say I feel like my Saturdays are a lot of, although I tend to be pretty aspirational. I'm like, I'm going to do this. And if I don't get up at a good time and get going on stuff, my whole day will just be gone and I will have frittered it away doing stuff. So I have to, if I'm going to be productive, I got to decide I'm going to be productive. Anyway, so to that point, what would you guys say, what threatens to take over your weekend or to help you lose your weekend? Because I think you can be very disappointed in your weekend or you can feel like your weekend was super restorative and you kind of rocked it. So what makes the difference?
I feel like for me, if I sleep in on a Saturday, nothing will get done the whole rest of the Saturday. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I have to also be intentional about getting up and then getting the things that I need to get done first. That way it's out of my mind so that I can focus and just relax when that time it comes when I'm relaxing. I'm actually relaxing as opposed to sitting on the couch eating a snack, thinking about all the things that I actually should be doing. So I think getting the productive stuff out of the way first has really helped.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm going to piggyback on that because I will say that my worst Saturdays in particular, my Sundays, I have a lot more structure because of church. But Saturdays, if at any point in the morning I get on my phone and I start doing fill in the blank, scrolling through social media, playing a game, looking through random texts, texting random people that I probably don't need to be talking to via text. My whole day is gone, and it is like depression central. So I can't even – if it's like 1 p.m. and I have not accomplished something or I feel like my to-do list was derailed, then of course, then I'm just going to sit on the couch with a snack and be like, well, there went my day. I can't do anything else. So that's just like a mental thing. But Georgia, how about you?
I think I prefer to get stuff done throughout the week because I don't like to have my weekends be like, I need to get my car checked and da 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 da, because that to me is not restful nor fun. Yeah. And I like to be rested and have a good fun time and like go on hikes or go visit my family. So I try my best to get the boring kind of like to-do list type of stuff done throughout the week. So that way my Saturdays and Sundays aren't bombarded with like the things I don't want to do, like getting my car checked or like those kinds of things. And so then that way, if I need to tidy up the house, that's like a small chore I can do on a Saturday, but it's not like, oh my gosh, the house is a sty and it's like exhausting. It's like, okay, like I need to kind of like wipe the counters down, but nothing big. So I try to do the stuff that I don't like throughout the week so that my weekend can be more about the things that I'm really excited about or the things that bring joy to my life.
Yeah, that's extremely mindful. Wow. Okay.
I find that mine's pretty similar to yours, Lisa. I have to be pretty careful to not get on my phone first thing during the day. That first hour especially, it doesn't even necessarily have to be productive for me, especially if it's going to be a Saturday where I know I need to rest and recuperate before the week starts. Where as long as I'm just allowing myself to kind of keep my soul calm, don't get on your phone, get in the word, pray, go for a walk, drink coffee, do stuff like that. That's good. But yeah, I have to be very guarded during that first hour of the weekend. And not to say that I won't scroll at some point during the day, but that starting off the weekend that way, if it starts off that way, it's pretty hard to get back up.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Also, and because I have a housemate, so I'm going to bring this in because she doesn't always listen to the show. So don't tell her to listen to this part, friends. She's someone who will on the regular sleep in on a Saturday. So, which is funny because then I try to control both of our schedules and I'm like, okay, when are we going to get to these bathrooms, you know, or whatever? And then I'm just like total drill sergeant of like, and she's like, you need to just get out of my business and whatever. And then I just get mad. And so, yeah, that can also derail a Saturday when I feel like I have plans that she or fill in the blank, someone else I have plans with, you know, I feel like I need to be ordering everyone's schedule. That can be pretty crazy. Okay, now all of you mentioned prioritizing church on Sunday. And, you know, there are a lot of young adults who don't go to church or who go maybe a weekend a month or whatever. Why would you say that that's an important part of your weekend?
Because I need it.
Good answer.
It's honestly that simple. I mean, I need to be around people who are going to encourage me in my walk with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And there's just something really beautiful if you go to church on Sunday morning to just start your week saying, okay, God, you're going to come first. And I want to be around people who are trying to follow you, who are going to inspire me to do the same, and that I can be poured into. And also, if you're volunteering, you can pour into other people as well.
Yeah.
But I need to be in a public setting where we're worshiping the Lord together, because that's one of the best things in life is to remember this is what it's like to praise the Lord together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's good because not that this is your motivation, John, but being volunteering on a Sunday morning is a good reason to get up and go.
Like
people are expecting you to be there. You know, I think a lot of people just drift in and out of church and they're not known, they're not seen, they're not part of it, you know? And so I think that is a good way to say, hey, I'm here, I'm part of this. I'm going to be present. So that's good.
Yeah. I think to your point, if people drift in and out, you're never going to form good community and you're never going to be able to call those people your family. And I feel like being in Colorado, this is the first time I've really felt like my church family is my church family. Mm-hmm. And so I miss them. Like, if I'm being honest, like, I love getting to see them on Sundays and getting to interact with people that I don't get to interact with, you know, during my work week. And so I love being able to see how they're doing. I love being able to worship with my church family and to just be, again, restorative And I think that taking a Sabbath is important. And I'm not going to sit here and be like, I'm really perfect at taking Sabbaths, blah, blah, blah. But I do think that, like, Sundays when they're slow and they're, you know, just all about being with your church family and being with the Lord, I think, yeah, you're just set up for a week that's going to be so much better just because you've started it with a firm foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, too, the opportunity to be encouraged by worshiping in community, mm-hmm. but also that is an encouragement to other people. I think when we're all in one room, all worshiping God, I think, too, I mean, clearly the Bible commands that we should be in community and going to church. So I think that's a reason of itself. But I think it is a good way to start the week with your eyes on the Lord and not on all the busyness and all the chaos of the world, but just that time to really just rest in the Lord.
Mm-hmm. So kind of in light of that, and as you're thinking of your weekends, and a couple of you alluded to this, would you say, like, do you have to have a mix of alone time or with friend time? Or are there times when it gets overwhelming, either like, oh, I've just been by myself, this was really boring, or there were just way too many people involved in this weekend? Well, Georgia, if you have three activities, your morning, noon, and night on a Saturday, what then you have to crash on Sunday a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of it is that just the rhythm of, like, kind of my friend group and that kind of thing is that, like, we all kind of, like, do stuff on Saturdays and we like to be with each other and hang out and whatever that looks like. And then I just find that on Sundays, if we do hang out or if we do, you know, if there is an event going on, it's usually chill. Like, it's a very chill thing. Whereas Saturday might be like, okay, we're going to start off with, like, we're going to Goodwill and then we're going on a hike and then we're going to have a movie night and then we're going to have a game night. And it's like, I feel like we try to, you know, kind of fill Saturdays. And not every Saturday is that like that. I'm not trying to be like, I'm Miss Popular. That's not what I'm trying to get at. Not every Saturday
we'll
is
put
whack.
George's phone number in the show notes.
Hey guys, you can come hang out with me.
Yeah.
But I do feel like for me, I do have to have pockets of time where I'm by myself, and it's not like it's not usually structured. Like, it's not like I'm gonna spend the morning just 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. just Georgia, me, myself, and I. It's usually just like whatever pocket of time there is, whether I'm driving or I'm just at the house, you know, before I go somewhere or whatever, or if I'm just walking with my dog. I just like to have a couple of moments by myself, so that I can actually be restful and not like filling my time to the brim. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that's where Sundays come in, is that I really appreciate Sundays when they're slow. And my roommates go to a church together and I go to church at a different place. And so it's kind of nice because then, like, as I drive to church, that's like alone time that I get to be in worship and where I get to pray on my way to church and I don't have to worry about, like, anything else. So I think that's also kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, it's good. Christina, so I was going to ask you, because you mentioned that you're in seminary, so a lot of your weekends have homework. Is that like a, where are you on the timeline of that? Is this like your foreseeable future, or are you like, I can't wait until I'm done with seminary and I can start doing XYZ on the weekend?
Yeah, this is my first seminary class, so
oh,
we're kind of,
wow. Yeah, you're
it'll
on the
be
front
my
end.
Life for the next
No wonder coffee shops and studying are okay so far. Okay.
So far it's been great. I love my classes and I love just being able to go to a coffee shop and mm-hmm. kind of have that alone time, but still feel like the time that I have alone is productive. Yeah. So I think not having my alone time be sitting in my bed, doom scrolling on Instagram or Twitter yeah. or wherever else. So I think, like, when I am alone, I'm trying to be productive and trying to be mindful about that time. So whether that's cleaning or mm-hmm. seminary homework, which is most of the weekends lately, mm-hmm. Or like going to the grocery store, doing those productive things by myself so that when I do have time, being able to pour into people, whether that's like a movie night or whether that is going and doing a 14er or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. good. Okay, so kind of as we wrap here, what would be your advice to someone who is just like, I always get to Monday and I feel like my weekends just weren't good, or they just weren't restful, or it got away from me again? What have been some small changes or some good hacks that you guys have seen work for you?
I'm a big fan of planning ahead, mm-hmm. and maybe even the night before, say Friday night, really just map out, okay, what are a few things that I truly want to or slash need to accomplish mm-hmm. this weekend? And just write them down on a list when you're, I find my brain is a little fresher in the evenings compared to the mornings. It's different for every person, mm-hmm. but I find that I plan best in the evenings. And I'll write some stuff down that, hey, I'm going to get done this weekend. And I'm saying this to myself as much as listeners, don't try to plan too much, mm-hmm. But plan a few essentials that you need to get done. And that way, when you wake up on Monday morning, you're not kicking yourself saying, oh, I wish I had done this or I should have done this. But yeah, be intentional and just make some time to do it.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I think you got to plan ahead. And I think if you're someone who feels FOMO or something like that, if you don't start planning your weekend on Monday, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, if you know, don't scramble and try to be like, oh, I want to hang out or I want to hike with someone. It's like people start planning a week before. So I feel like on Monday, if you're like, okay, I want to hike with these people, then on Monday, be like, Saturday, do you guys have time? So yeah, I think planning ahead, especially if you want to make plans with people, don't plan that stuff on Friday, because by then a lot of people have made plans. And so if you don't want to feel FOMO or if you don't want to feel like, oh, I'm not doing anything fun, then take the time to find that thing you want to do.
Yeah. Well, and I've got to think, like, if people are hiking this weekend, they're probably hiking next weekend. And so it's like, you don't have to go on every hike, people. Like, sometimes you may just need a down day or you may need to, you know, kind of that FOMO thing. We want to do it all and we want to be, and it'll be like, it'll come around again. And so, you know, pick a few things, but you don't have to do everything.
Yeah, someone will have a movie night. Someone will have a game night. It doesn't have to be every time.
Yeah.
And I think, like, having that list of things that you know you have to get done. But I'm a big encourager of making them fun while you do it. So, like, if you have a whole bunch of errands to run, maybe stop and get some coffee on your way. Or, like, something just to make it a little more exciting. If you have a whole bunch of cleaning to do, maybe there's a show you've been wanting to watch that you can watch while you do it. And just taking the normal things that you have to do and making them enjoyable, relaxing, and fun.
Mm-hmm. Or even errands, like grab a friend that has to do the same errands, like go grocery shopping together or go, fill up your cars or whatever, meal prep. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Or even call a friend.
Good, yeah.
FaceTime someone while you cook.
FaceTime, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Or talk to your parents while you're doing the chores
or errands.
Call
your mom. She wants you to call.
I do like the idea of breaking things up into smaller chunks, because if I'm on a Friday night and my goal for Saturday is clean my entire house, I'm in for a pretty sad weekend. So making
just
it...
Start with the toilets.
Small. Start with the toilets, because you could do those in 5 hours. No, I'm just kidding. Well, good thoughts, you guys. I hope this is really helpful for everyone and encouraging. So I'm looking forward to the weekend. Woo woo.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
Well, folks, we are here for this week's culture segment. You know now, with the many, many cultures that I have introduced, that I'm always excited when we get guests in who are experts in their field on a certain topic, who have maybe walked a few more steps than we have and have walked it out in the culture, in the community, in their own families. And so today's guest is no exception. I have got a professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, Nancy Piercy, here with me for this week's culture segment. In addition to the work that she does at the university, she's a speaker, she's an author. In fact, Nancy, I didn't tell you this when we were talking earlier, but I actually read I think pretty much when it came out, How Now Shall We Live, which you wrote with Chuck Colson, who's now with Jesus. But that was just, I remember reading that book and first of all, just feeling so learned and grown up, you know, walking through what he had to say and all this. But she has actually written many books. And so we're going to have links to her and her works in the show notes. But Nancy, welcome to The Boundless Show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is great. And today we're going to talk about, speaking of books, her book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. And it's interesting that we're talking about this today because I've actually had a number in our audience, some in my church, some just my friends, where we've had conversations about the book in the sense of, yeah, did you hear that this came out? Did you hear that there was a review of it? You know, yeah, this is great. And so I knew that we wanted to have you on the show because young adults, I mean, who is living this, walking this more maybe in the workplace, certainly in education, in universities, but some of these young adults. And so it's our privilege, Nancy, for you to be part of this conversation. I know in writing this book and the topic of it, it's not just something academic for you. It starts way back in childhood. And so I would love for you to just paint the picture of your own experience with this, which I think is so helpful to kind of give a framework of like, you're not just making stuff up and you're not just trying to be like, oh, I'm going to, you know, just throw around some expertise here. So kind of walk us back to that point in your own life.
Yeah, I start the book with the story of my childhood because I was raised by a severely physically abusive father. And he wouldn't say, do this, I'll spank you. He'd say, do this, I'll beat you. And he's quite open about it. And so it was fists, it was kicking, and it was traumatic, not just for myself, but watching my siblings get beaten. And so when I became a young adult, as you can imagine, I ricocheted off into extreme feminism and read all the great feminist books. I always had some feminist book on my bedside table. And then I became a Christian and had to sort of rethink the whole thing from scratch. And as I was interviewed by a Christian psychologist who said, well, at least we know you're not speaking from an ivory tower. You know, you're speaking from the trenches as someone who's actually been there. You know, that coming up with a biblical view of masculinity was a struggle, a lifelong struggle. It wasn't easy. So, yeah, this, you're right. This is blood, sweat, and tears right here in this book.
It is. And I do want to say, kind of in continuing your story, because it's so helpful, that you kind of described yourself as what, like an agnostic before actually going to LaBrie and Francis Schaeffer, who's like one of just the stalwarts of the faith, you know, again, also now with the Lord, but and really had a turnaround in coming back to your Christian faith.
Yes, I did, because so my parents were Lutheran. They were Scandinavian. I don't know if you know this, but all Scandinavians are Lutheran. It's kind of like all Irish are Catholic. And so it was kind of an ethnic background. But when I was in high school, I started asking questions about my faith. And I asked my father, point blank, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me. I said, that's it? That's all you got? And I actually had a chance to talk to a seminary dean who, by the way, was an uncle of mine. And all he said was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes, as if it were a psychological phase that you would outgrow. And so I very intentionally decided, well, if I don't have good reasons for Christianity, I shouldn't believe it. You know, you shouldn't believe anything that you don't have good reasons for. Mm-hmm. So I was about halfway through high school when I very intentionally walked away from my Christian upbringing and started on a search for truth. I figured, I guess it's up to me to figure out what is true. And I literally wanted to study all the religions and philosophies that were out there and figure out for myself which one was true. But it was a couple of years later, I was in Europe. We had lived in Europe when I was a child, and I loved it. So I'd gone back. And that's how I kind of stumbled across Francis Schaeffer's ministry, which is in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And it's called LaBrie. It's in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. So LaBrie means the shelter. And that was the first time I ever encountered Christian apologetics. I had no idea that Christianity could be defended with good reasons and arguments, that it could stand up to the claims of all of the secular isms that I had absorbed by that time. And so it took two trips. I left after only a month, became a Christian just through reading, and then went back for 4 months. So all of my writing was very much influenced by that, because I just have a heart for answering the questions that young people have, because I had those questions and I didn't have anyone to answer them for me until I went to Libri. And so everything I write and speak about now all has something to do with apologetics.
That's great. Well, and so I want to ask you, because this is kind of a broad question, or I should say it encompasses a span of history. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, there are many young men out there who are facing confusing cultural messages about what men should be or what men are. And, you know, it's like you could pick up something, you know, from one source and it's going to contradict with another source and whatnot. So I'm wondering, how are you seeing those messages today? And are there clues throughout history or certain watershed moments where we've seen like a pivot of like what the scripts have been given to men?
Yeah, well, let me start with some of the really negative messages that young men are exposed to today, because that's obviously the main reason I wrote the book. Is I read things like the Washington Post had an article titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" And I was shocked. You know, a mainstream publication like that? A Huffington Post editor wrote hashtag kill all men. And you can buy T-shirts that say so many men, so little ammunition.
Wow.
And even books with very blunt titles like I Hate Men and No Good Men and Are Men Necessary? Mm-hmm. And then to my own surprise, I found even some secular men are jumping on that bandwagon. A very secular male author wrote a book in which he said, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. And then this one you may have seen because it was actually in the news a couple of months ago, but the director of the movie Avatar was quoted in the news saying, testosterone is a toxin and you have to work it out of your system. So this is what young men are growing up with today. There's a psychotherapist who writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal, and she said, the young men coming into my practice now are feeling demoralized and depressed because they feel like they're growing up in an environment that's hostile to masculinity. And I'll tell you my own story. When I told my class at Houston Christian University that I was writing a book on masculinity, one male student shot back, what masculinity? It's been beaten out of us. Mm-hmm. So this is the environment in which young men are growing up today. And so the message of my book is, isn't it time to maybe have some compassion on men and boys, because they are, in fact, doing worse today than they have in the past? And I think it's partly because of these negative messages.
Yeah. Well, speaking of those negative messages, I think this was so jarring to me to read this. You cite a study in the book from Michael Kimmel, where he asked a group of West Point cadets what it means to be a good man and then what it means to be a real man. And the answers he received were different. Talk to us a little bit about that, because I thought that was so fascinating.
Yes, I put this right at the beginning of the book, partly because this has been the most controversial book I've ever written. You know, when people heard I was writing the book, invariably the first question was, whose side is she on? Like, you, as if you have to take a side. And so I put this study at the beginning of the book. You're right, it started with West Point, but then the sociologist, he's not a Christian, but he gets invited to speak all around the world. And so he's done this experiment all around the world, you know, from you know, Great Britain to Switzerland to Australia and everywhere in between. And what he does is he asks young men two questions. First, what does it mean to be a good man? You know, if you're at a funeral and in the eulogy, somebody says he was a good man, what does that mean? And the sociologist said all around the world, young men had no trouble answering that. They would immediately start listing things like duty, honor, integrity, sacrifice, look out for the little guy, be a protector, be a provider, be responsible. And he'd say, where'd you learn that? They'd say, well, I don't know. It's just in the air we breathe. Or if they were in a Western country, they would often say it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage. And so, you know, what that tells us is all around the world, men do have they're made in God's image, and they do have an intrinsic, innate sense of what it means to be a good man. But then the sociologist would follow up with a second question and say, well, what does it mean if I say to you, man up, be a real man? And the young men themselves would say, oh, no, that's completely different. You know, that means be tough, never show weakness, play through pain, be competitive, win at all costs, get rich, get laid, to use their language. Mm-hmm. And so the sociologists concluded that men do feel trapped between these two different scripts. You know, on the one hand, we might call it general revelation, right? Special revelation is the Bible, but general revelation is what we can figure out from the world God made. And men do know inherently, universally, what it means to be the good man, to provide and protect for those they love. And they also feel trapped by cultural messages that say, that highlight very different traits that can easily slide into more toxic traits like entitlement and dominance and control and so on. And so this is what we're up against. And I would say the good thing about it is it means that we have a much more positive way to approach these issues. Most men don't respond very well to being called toxic. Nobody would.
Yeah.
But what we can do is there a way to tap into that innate knowledge that all men have of what it means to be the good man? You know, can we affirm and support and encourage what they innately know? And that gives us a much more positive way to approach these issues.
Yeah. So what would you say, you know, I'm just thinking of like my circles of friends, even my own church, what's missing? Because there are many different types of folks listening, but largely we're a Christian audience. So a lot of the men listening now are going to be in churches. What's missing in the church where this is not really being taught or emulated, or what, like, how can men do this within the church better? Because we've often heard, you know, and again, women have long competed with men on many different levels, and now women outpace men in universities and whatnot. So I feel like there's always been this tension of competition. So is there something that men need to do differently in their circles, like within Christian community, or how could this kind of be a call collectively for them?
Well, one theme that I come back to several times in my book is the cultural mandate, because I think many men get the idea that the only thing that makes me a Christian is I go to church and I sing and pray, and that's not a big enough vision to capture the male imagination. But we go back to Genesis. And the cultural mandate, not every church even, you know, uses that term. So what it means is before the fall. So this is, you know, God's goal, God's objective, God's calling, even before the fall is, you know, God has created the heavens and the earth and the animals, and he creates the first human couple. And what is the very first thing he says to them? Be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And in the very streamlined language of Genesis 1, be fruitful and multiply doesn't just mean have children, because anthropologists tell us the family is the center of all the social institutions, right? So the extended family becomes the clan, becomes the tribe, you know, and social institutions for particular purposes like a government, you know, the state, the church, the school, the marketplace. So it really is a calling to develop all of these cultural institutions. And subdue the earth means harness the natural resources. So that means, well, most cultures start with agriculture, but then mining and technology and inventing computers and composing music. I had a student once who said, come on, composing music? And I play the violin. So I said, well, what's the violin made out of? Wood. And the bow? Horsehair. And so all the transcendent beauty we associate with music starts with harnessing the natural resources of the creation that God has given us. And I think this gives us a much bigger, fuller, richer calling, especially for men. This gives them scope for achievement and accomplishment and impact that sometimes our churches are not giving them such a rich view of the cultural mandate. It's called cultural mandate because the idea is, you know, when we sin, we get off the track. When we're saved, we're put back on the track. But what was the track? You know, what did God originally call the human race to do? And it is to build cultures. So I think that that cultural mandate could really enrich our the direction that churches give to men.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about, and I know you set up in the book kind of this idea that societies throughout history have, some have set up men as morally superior, some argue women, you know, it's kind of like this argument that is borne out in different areas. I would say bringing it into the evangelical context in our churches, and again, what we hear even here at the Boundless Show is women who will say, you know, maybe the married young women are saying, well, you know, this is all well and good, but in my home, I'm the one who's more spiritually pursuant of, you know, scripture, of the, I'm responsible for teaching my kids, I'm responsible, you know, my husband is just kind of absent or standing in the background. Women daters, and I'm kind of, okay, ladies and men who are listening, just chill, because I have a point here. Okay, Nancy's going to break this all down for us. You know, they'll be dating and women are like, well, I just can't find a guy who initiates prayer or who wants to talk about spiritual things or who wants, so how do we get past this impasse of frustrations of who's doing what and who's not doing what?
Yeah, so here a historical perspective can be really helpful. I have a lot of history in the book. You know, where did secular scripts for masculinity even come from? And I have to tell you, there's never been a time when women were thought to be morally and spiritually superior until the 19th century in the West. Up until then, all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, it was assumed that men were morally and spiritually superior. That here was their reasoning, you know, that the insight into right and wrong is a rational insight, and men are more rational, they were convinced, and therefore men are more virtuous. In fact, the word virtue comes from the Latin, V-I-R, means man, as in virile. Yeah. And so the word virtue had overtones of manly strength and honor. And that was the case all the way up into the 19th century. And how did it flip? Well, you know, before the Industrial Revolution, men worked alongside their families all day, right? Their wives and kids on the family farm, the family business, the family industry. And so the emphasis on male virtue was very much their caretaking role, their responsibility for the family. And the Industrial Revolution broke up the family business by taking work out of the home. And of course, men had to follow their work out of the home. And that's when we first begin to see people say, well, wait, men are losing that caretaking ethos. You know, men are becoming egocentric and self-centered and greedy and acquisitive and making their job into an idol. Literally, that's the language of the 19th century, that men were turning financial success into an idol. But that's also when American society began to secularize. And it happened first in the public square. So people began to say that these large public institutions that were emerging, like factories and businesses and financial institutions and universities and the state, that they should be operating by what they called scientific principles. But what they meant was value-free. You know, don't bring your private values into the public realm. And since it was men who were working in the public realm and getting that secular education, men became secular in their outlooks sooner than women did. And so this is where that tension was first created that you mentioned, that women, well, let me put it even stronger. If values are kicked out of the public realm, where would they be cultivated? Mm-hmm. In the private realm. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first time ever in human history that women were said to be morally superior. Women were made the moral guardians of society. Women were said to be spiritually more sensitive and so on. It arose because of the Industrial Revolution when men were separated from their family and became more secular in their outlook. And so what we need to do is say, okay, this is not the Christian view. You know, the Christian view has to be both women and men are equally fallen and equally need God's salvation. And I do think, I've talked to young people too. I was on an interview with a young married couple, newlyweds. And so I turned the questions back on them. And I said, do you think that double standard is still in the Christian world? And they said what you just said, that absolutely, that men are just assumed to be more naturally prone to sin and vice and pornography, especially sexual sin, and that the woman is in a sense pressured to be the one who holds the line, who holds him in check. And if she doesn't do her job, then it'll be her fault if he goes off into pornography. So I think that the double standard is very much still at work in the Christian world. And I do think that we need to say, look, this is not intrinsic to the way God made us. It is an artifact of the 19th century responding to the Industrial Revolution. And if it's something that was created by culture, we can uncreate it and get back to a more biblical view.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, also women, ladies, those of us listening, we can sometimes shoot this whole issue in the foot by being those catty women, by taking our own cultural clues and trying to get control and trying to stamp men down, you know, in order to over, you know, falsely correct a lot of things, what we're taking from history and whatnot. And so I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned there. Now, to that point, Nancy, I do want you, before we go here, to quickly address what we've seen as an overcorrection in the opposite direction. And some of it has been a misapplication of biblical submission, specifically marital submission in scripture, whether out of Ephesians or wherever we see it. So that we've seen, you know, some have thrown around terms like patriarchy, patriarchal, obviously moving towards elements of marital oppression and abuse, even what you saw in your own home. How do we have safeguards against that within the Christian community? Again, it would be great if we could all say, here's how Christians act, and it's totally perfect. And then there's just the world, and of course, they're depraved and whatnot. But we're seeing a lot of examples of overreach and misapplication, even within the church, where we're having to address it, even from a corporate standpoint. So what would be your caution towards that, and what we could do about it as believers?
Yeah, I won't have time to get into the details, but one of the most interesting findings was that Christian men who are truly committed and attend church regularly test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers, and that it is primarily nominal Christian men who test out with more toxic characteristics. In fact, so toxic that their wives report the lowest level of happiness, they spend the least amount of time with their kids. They divorce at a higher rate even than secular couples, 20% higher. And they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence, even higher than secular men. So, of course, I had to deal with this in the book. It would look like I was, you know, sweeping under the carpet. But I found that up until very recently, books on abuse in Christian homes were very one-sided. They blamed it on the wife. You know, if only you would be more loving, if you would be more forgiving, if you would be more submissive, if you would cook his favorite foods, you know, he would blossom into the man you want him to be. I'm quoting an elder who told an abused wife that he will blossom. And you know, it's just not human nature. If you acquiesce and try to placate someone who's willing to be a bully, you know, who's willing to hurt others to get what he wants, acquiescing doesn't work. It emboldens him. He gets worse. And we know that, you know, with a playground bully, you know, or in international affairs with a belligerent nation. So I'm happy to report that newer books on abuse in Christian homes, and I quote them all, so if you need some, I quote them. Newer books are finally starting to say that doesn't work. What you need to do when there's actual sin in the marriage relationship is what Jesus told us in Matthew 18, which is you hold people accountable for their sin. You know, you confront them yourself first, and if they don't listen to you, you bring a few more witnesses, and if they don't listen to them, you bring it before the church. And if they don't listen to them, that might be time for some kind of church discipline. So I'm very happy to be able to say that the books that are now available on abuse in Christian homes are much more realistic and much more willing to hold men accountable. I have to say that because numerically speaking, most abuse is by men. It is sometimes women, but numerically speaking, half of all female homicides are by intimate partners. And that means husband or former husband, boyfriend or former boyfriend. Half of all women who are murdered, the comparable number for men is 3%. So abuse is primarily a male issue. And it is time for churches to equip women, to empower women to stand up and follow Jesus on this one, Matthew 18.
Yeah, which is why I think it is so good, and we've had other experts on who've talked about this, that it is so good for men to have other men in their lives. So a lot of times, you know, women will try to be, whether it's the guy they're dating or they're married to, try to be his Holy Spirit, try to tell him what he should be doing, you know, virtually never works. And so that community of brotherhood of Christian guys holding one another accountable, being real, getting into one another's business is such a great model. model for seeing that sharpening and seeing that accountability. I see that on so many fronts in that way. So, well, Nancy, we always run out of time so fast. I want to let folks know, we often do this here on the show, that we're making a copy of Nancy's book. And again, I've been talking to Professor Nancy Piercy. She's the author of many books, but we've been talking about The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. And we want to make a copy of this book available to you for a gift of any amount to Boundless. So you go to boundless.org. You can search for 842, this week's episode. You'll see the book cover there. You just click on it. You give a gift, whatever you can afford to Boundless, and we're going to send a copy of Nancy's book to you. And this could be a great discussion starter among your friends, family, whatever that looks like for you. Again, like I said, so many of the audience members here have mentioned, like, this is a topic we need to talk about. And so here is your chance. So you go ahead and do that. And again, like I said, we will send a copy of the book to you. So Nancy, again, thank you so much for your time and for the, I'm sure, Leviathan effort that went into writing this book, putting it all together. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
Folks, here we are for our inbox as we finish out the show, and I'm actually going to answer this week's question. It is kind of about what I would call pseudo-dating or the hope of dating, which, I mean, who of us has not been there? So I feel for you, listener. So let me jump into the question. One of our female listeners says, there's a guy at my church that I've been interested in for about 2 years, and I can't move on. I've been praying about it, and I try to think about other things, but this guy has always been on the back of my mind. I've spent some time with him throughout the years, going through young adult activities or events, but I don't think he knows that I have feelings for him. What should I do? Because I want him to ask me out. Okay, such a great question and such a hard dilemma. And I know for many of you that are frustrated because you feel like, okay, as the female in this situation, is it even my place to ask a guy out? How do I move the needle? I feel so powerless. I totally understand. Okay, frustrating. Okay, so that said, there are definitely some things that you can do, but I want to give you some caveats because all of them have risks and rewards. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to show my hand here and say that I generally ascribe to the belief espoused in He's Just Not That Into You, movie or book, pick your poison, that is that if a guy is interested in a girl, he will find some way to get her attention or to try to move himself into her sphere. So the fact that he hasn't done this with you in 2 years may mean that he has other interests or that he, you know, is interested in someone else or just isn't interested in dating or whatever, you know, if he's actually been in your sphere and you say that he has because you've done events and activities with him. So I'm going to say that because it can actually be hard and super frustrating when you are hoping for something to go somewhere and it's not going anywhere. So the alternatingly frustrating and relieving part of this is that you really don't have control over this. So there's an element of you having to let go. You cannot manufacture something or make something happen here. So I want you to take a deep breath in light of that and realize that, you know, some of this is out of your hands, so you might need to have a fair amount of chill in this situation. That said, the question is, what do you do? What can you actively do? And so I'm going to just say, you know, you're saying that you want him to ask you out. First of all, what have you tried so far? I mean, you mentioned being in his, you know, orbit by virtue of being in activities, but do you talk to him? Do you talk to him one-on-one instead of making random asides in group conversations? Are you ever alone when you're around him? I've talked before here on the show about men trying to break into this posse of women, and that's very intimidating and quite frankly can be super weird. And so make yourself available. Sit alone at church sometimes. Go to small group alone. Be by yourself. So if he wants to break in and have a conversation with you, he can do that with ease. So just some of those things of being aware of how you show up in situations, how you're communicating, I think are going to help you on the front end. Now, the next thing is you can make a pseudo-aggressive move or you can make an aggressive move. You can even ask this guy out if you want, but you know that's entirely your decision, but there is a risk because the risk could be that you kind of show your hand, you make something known, he's not interested. And then all of a sudden he's like, yeah, I don't want to get into that mess. And so I'm going to pull away. So are you ready for that? I mean, some women will tell me, I'd rather not know. I'd rather just wait it out. Okay, well, then you have to deal with the fact that you're going to be in a limbo probably indefinitely. And so again, like I said, there's risk and there's reward to this. And so it can be difficult on either side. That said, you can certainly have conversations with him in a way that indicate that you are open to dating, that you are interested in meeting some of the guys in your group, and that you're interested in meeting and getting to know him more in particular. Maybe there's a shared book that you guys have in common or that you've heard him mention. Maybe there's something, a shared interest that you have. So I think there are a lot of ways that this can go. All that to say, you have to decide at what level do you want information and what are you willing to give up in order to get it? Because again, once you cross that threshold, you cannot come back. And demanding an answer or demanding information is going to put you in a spot of him possibly pulling away because he's like, oh yeah, well now I know that she's interested in me. I'm not interested. And so I don't want to give her that impression. I need to move on. But you will have your answer. All that to say, there are a couple times here at Boundless where we have addressed this more particularly. Two, I want to give you a heads up on. One is an old podcast episode, and if you go to boundless.org and search, I'll ask you out if, it's a group of guys who talk about kind of what helps them move the needle towards being willing to ask women out. The second is an advice column that we had from back in the day, answered by our own Scott Croft, and it's titled, Is It Okay for a Woman to Ask Out a Man? That will just give you some insight as well. And overall, I would say pray about this. Pray that God would reveal your heart and your motivations in this, that he would give you direction and wisdom of how to approach this. I think going there first and then going into the practicals will help you and ease your mind and your heart. All right. Well, hopefully this has been encouraging to you and that you can find some direction to move forward a little bit with some courage and hopefully some grace. Well, that's it, folks, for this week's show. We do want to hear from you. If you have a question, you can write to us at editor@boundless.org, or you can hit us up in our DMs, whether on Instagram or you can find us on Facebook. Submit a question and we will hopefully get to it in the future. In the meantime, I will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org from Focus on the Family.
It can be challenging to inspire your community to see life the way God sees it. So what's the solution? Well, on June 15th, Focus on the Family is hosting Sea Life 24. And no matter where you are or who you are, you can be a part of this free event with speakers like Ben and Kirsten Watson and real stories about choosing life. Sea Life 24 will inspire you to translate your faith into action. Register today at sealife24.org.